morning, I'm Daniel Browning. Nice to be with you here on RN for Books and Arts Daily. Today we meet the man behind The Turning, more a cinema experience than a film, based on the 2004 novel by Tim Winton.
I left them twisting, turning below. There were no more faces and the steel was dark, damp, jagged, like an old man's mouth drivelling beyond repair, or the toothed gullet of an aged shark.
And one of this country's greatest living writers, David Malouf, on an important and largely forgotten classic Australian novel. Stay with me here on Books and Arts Daily. My first guest is one of this country's greatest living writers, David Malouf. He's a novelist, a librettist, a poet, a writer of memoir. He's written 9 novels, including The Great World and Remembering Babylon, which have won various prizes, including the Commonwealth Writers' Prize and the Impact Dublin Literary Award. He's been shortlisted for the Man Booker and he's won the Pascal Prize for Critical Writing. But today he's here with me to give us his critical assessment, because David Malouf's written a reflective introduction to a largely forgotten classic Australian novel from the 1930s. Let's find out what it is in a moment. David Malouf, welcome to Books and Arts Daily.
Thank you, Daniel.
Before we get to the novel, I just want to get your thoughts on the announcement out of London overnight about the Man Booker Prize and the eligibility rules. They've now decided that the Man Booker should be people who write in English should be eligible for the Man Booker. As we know, it's only ever been writers from Britain, Ireland and the Commonwealth. Some authors aren't happy about that development. What's your take?
Oh, I'm not unhappy about it. I mean, the Man Booker has established itself as the most successful prize because the best known, best managed. They've already changed it in various ways. I mean, when I was shortlisted, they simply announced 6 shortlisted writers. Then they announced a long list, you know, a couple of months beforehand. But one of the interesting things about the Booker Prize is it's the only prize I know that makes a huge fuss of the long list and the short list. And in fact, to get on a short list for the Booker is a huge thing, because for 2 or 3 months before they announce the prize, people are looking at all the people on the short list, and that's the way to do it. And as far as writers are concerned, that's the most useful thing to do. So to extend it in that way and to take in writing in English, in America, I think is, I thought that was something that was inevitable in the end.
Well, let's move on. We're here to talk about Kenneth Mackenzie's The Young Desire It, which was first published in 1937. It's just been re-released as part of the Text Classic series of Australian novels. When did you first come across this novel?
I'd always been aware of its existence because Mackenzie is a poet as well as a novelist and has always been anthologized. And he writes poetry which is very different from most people's poetry. It's very dense and very contorted, and it's very interiorized. Has a kind of religious dimension. So I knew him as a writer, but I'd not actually read any of the novels. And I really read this novel for the first time about 9 months ago. And I'd had it, I had 2 copies on my bookshelf, but for some reason I had never actually taken it up. I'd always intended to read it, but had never actually done so. When I did, I was really astonished. Because this is, in many ways, the first modernist novel in Australian fiction. It's so different from other writings of the time to this extent that, you know, most Australian writing until I thought Patrick White had been very largely extroverted and about action and about Australians as highly social people. This is utterly, utterly interiorised. And it looks forward to the kind of novels that a lot of people were going to write from the early 70s onwards, including myself. I mean, this is a precursor I didn't know about.
Mm. In your essay, your introductory essay to this reissued version of the novel, you describe it as very nearly perfect. Can you explain what perfection looks like to David
Malouf?
Well,
the thing is that being a modernist novel, that's the other version of it, and interiorised, it's not much about exterior action. Mm. So an awful lot of the people who make comments on this book over the decades, the people who've read it, tell us it's a novel in which nothing happens. And that's, when I say modernist, one of the things about the whole modernist notion of a piece of fiction is that you lose the plot. And
literally lose the plot,
and something else takes over as the driving force of the book, and I think that's what happens here. When I say perfect, I mean sentence for sentence and paragraph by paragraph. The voice here, the tone is impeccable, and also every sentence is musically perfect. I mean, they are quite difficult sentences in some ways, but the cadence and the choice of words is absolutely precise. And, you know, that's what I mean by nearly perfect. Mm.
Sometimes I found myself reading it aloud in order to make sense of it. But let's move on to the plots. It's about a boy, 15-year-old boy, Charles Fox, sent away to boarding school. We do know that it's semi-autobiographical for the writer. Maybe you could just kind of brief us on the plot.
Well, the interesting thing to me about it is that this is not just a boy going to boarding school. This is a boy who's been brought up almost like a wild child in utterly Rousseau-like circumstances. He has lived on property in the country with nature, with his mother and a couple of servants, and that's it. He has never learned how to deal with society, and he's never learned to deal with other males. So when he is brought to the school at the age of 13, virtually everything he is confronted by, how ordinary it may be to other people, is new to him. Mm. And he has to work out how you deal with it. How do I deal with this circumstance, and what is the right way of dealing with it, the way which is manly? Mm. And the school itself is quite strange, because it's a very, very old-fashioned boarding school on an English of an English style, where the students the education is that the classics, sport, and music are what you use to shape the man, and where all the teachers are English, dealing with what they think are unmade young Australians.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm with David Malouf, and we're talking about a forgotten classic, Kenneth Mackenzie's The Young Desirate, which has just been reissued as a classic by the Australian publishing house Text. So this young boy is surrounded by women for most of his life. He undergoes an initiation, some terrible psychological shocks, and some people say not much happens in this novel. In an interior way, a lot does happen, and in the first 20 pages, tell us what happens to this young man, Charles Fox.
Well, he hasn't been at school more than half an hour before he is sexually assaulted, because he's a very, very pretty child. And some older boys immediately sort of grab him and take him off and say, what have we got here? Is this a girl or a boy? And so there's a sort of sexual assault that takes place, which is very shocking. But the interesting thing about it, and this is true of the whole book, He himself doesn't take it as shocking. What he simply says is, oh, how do you deal with this? Mm. And he deals with it by developing what he thinks of as resistance. Before this, he has been entirely innocent of the notion of evil, of any kind of physical assault, of any kind of challenge to the fact that you are an utterly free little agent. And that's the beginning of all of that. But he also takes it for granted, and this is what the whole book, you need to know about the whole book, that the existence of landscape and the existence of weather is entirely for him. It's an extension of his sensibility and his consciousness. It's kind of got no objective existence. And so that's very, very peculiar.
Those are the kind of lessons, I guess, we learn when we first go to school at five. He's 15. His development has been delayed. His ego has been allowed to, grow in a kind of untrammeled way. But to go from that kind of background and then be thrown into an institution like the school, he undergoes quite a lot of heavy experiences. He has a relationship with the teacher, Penworth. Well, a friendship, but something. It's not straightforward, and it's not an easy subject matter that's covered in this novel. The relationship between Penworth and Charles Fox.
Oh, look, there's several things that make the book difficult at this point for us to read, as it might have been. He might have expected us to read it when he was writing. One is that it predates the existence of the notion of teenager. Mm. When he is writing, a 14 or 15 year old boy is a young man, not a child. Most people at that age were out working. And we're told in the book by him that most of the teachers were young for their age and inexperienced in that kind of way, and most of the boys were old for their age. So when he's confronted with Penworth, who's a young man I take to be 25 or 26, and who's an Englishman who feels very deracinated here, he finds somebody who takes an interest in him, and he wants that, and he wants the man's affection. He knows nothing about sex. He knows all about emotions, and he knows all about physical eroticism or something, but he doesn't actually know anything about sex. And the man himself is utterly, utterly shocked by his own response to Charles. He is the master on duty in an act of bullying the very first night the boy is there, and the boy tumbles out of a dirty clothes basket where the other boys have thrown him stark naked. So the master himself is astonished by his own sexual reaction to the boy, and kind of that's what we're dealing with here.
There's a real sensitivity, though, with the way this relationship is handled by Mackenzie in his prose. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, really.
Yeah. Well, again,
there's no moral judgment.
No. He's writing before the penetration of our thinking by psychology, and especially sexual psychology. So he, like Mackenzie himself and his readers, perhaps, they don't know the names for anything. So there's no name calling. All there is behavior and people's need to deal with it. And when he is assaulted by Penworth, but it's not really an assault, it's a kind of an approach is all you could call it. But he faints in the gym, and when he wakes up, he's on Penworth's bed, and Penworth is sitting on the side of the bed, holding his feet. And then they have a conversation, which the boy is not very disturbed by, about, I take it to be about wet dreams. And he says to the man, I don't know anything about sex. You know, because he's got no one that he's ever been able to talk to it about. And at that point, Penworth kisses him. And he all he knows is that he does not want that. And that is because he has already had his great experience. Because back home during the first vacation, he has gone into a secret place of his own, as he thinks, and there's a girl there. And at first, she's for him almost like an emanation of the place. She's come out of the landscape. But that for him is the absolutely definitive experience. And so he's protected against any advances by Penworth because he already has felt what he wants. He doesn't see it as a sexual thing. He sees it as a mingling of souls and as a physical apparition which embodies everything he feels about the place and the world he's in.
I'm Daniel Browning. I'm speaking with David Malouf about the 1937 novel The Young Desirate, which has been reissued by Text. Let's get on to the man, Mackenzie. He's very interesting in himself. This is his first novel, and he writes it. He says he writes it in a 6 week a frenzied 6 week period. It's published in 1937, but 17 years old. Is that what?
No, I think what I'm beginning to work out, kind of what happened. Mm. He started the novel when he was 17. He was extraordinarily literate, and he wrote a version of the novel when he was 17. And when he came to Sydney later, he showed that novel to Norman Lindsay. And Norman Lindsay recommended him to the publishers in London, Jonathan Cape. And they then responded and told him, I think, that because I think the original book had another character, Morley, as the narrator. Mm. And they said to him they thought he should do something to write the book from the point of view of the boy's consciousness, Charles Fox. So they suggested that he make it much, much more interiorized. And he then went away for 6 weeks. And this is the point. Maybe he was then 21, 22, when he completely reconceived and wrote the final version of the book in 6 weeks, as he says, under enormous sort of emotional and time pressure.
Mm. Now, you, as you said earlier, you came to know Mackenzie through his poetry. What do we know about his literary career after the novel is published? Because he wins a gold medal from the Australian Literature Society. This book was critically understood and received, and you know, won a gold medal.
Yeah, it was very, very well reviewed in England. I think people in Australia were puzzled by it from the beginning, but the people at the gold medal that used to be called the Colonel Crouch Gold Medal when he
the
won
Colonel
it.
Crouch
Gold Medal, yes, and those people were very, very, very good judges of things, but theirs was not the common taste, I would have said. They frequently chose books which were difficult books. And so in 1937, they chose his book. And in 1938, they chose Patrick White's first book, Happy Valley. And neither of the books then had a huge follow-up in Australia. His book was reprinted later. It was reprinted by Douglas Stewart at Angus and Robertson in their Sirius, S-I-R-I-U-S series. and it was a book that continued to have a reputation and people didn't read it. I went back and looked at the commentary on it from various people over the years. The only person I felt who was utterly comfortable with it was Cecil Hadgraft, who called it the best book about youth and adolescence and growing up in Australian writing. Other people were a little bit dismissive of it as being sort of self-obsessed and highly eroticized and all this. They never want to tell you anything about it. They never tell you that there is this homosexual thing going on in it. They never tell you that, and they all slide over the question of whether the boy and the girl actually sleep with one another, have sex at the end. And for a lot of them, you could read that commentary and you would have no idea what it was actually about. Happens in the book. Yeah.
Why do you think then, the novel was forgotten? We were talking before off air about, you know, books come in and out of print and people rediscover them, but why do you think we don't know the name of Kenneth MacKenzie and this novel in particular? Why don't we know it so as much as we should?
I think because the whole idea of what Australian fiction was about, after Patrick White's The Ants story, for example, came to seem to be about the matter of Australia. That is, Australian identity, Australian history, the growth of the nation, Australian consciousness. And this was so individual and so personal that it didn't seem to belong in that world of subject matter, which was supposed to be the world of Australian literature. I think what's happened now is that most writers who are beginning to work would regard all of that kind of subject matter as having been done. And they are returning to an absolutely individual and personal subject matter. And this book suddenly seems to be back there, the book that was doing it all, you know, before the other thing. And so I think it is the right moment for us to look at this book again and to define again what we think the matter of fictional writing is in Australia.
David Maloof, a real pleasure to meet you in person today. Thanks for being my guest here on Books and Arts Daily.
Thank you for having me, Daniel.
And we were talking about, David Maloof and I were talking about Kenneth Seaforth MacKenzie's The Young Desire It. It's published by Text, or republished by Text, and David Maloof has written a very insightful introduction, which you must read before you launch into this novel. The Melbourne band, I think they're from Melbourne, the Tiger and Me, and that's their song Other Friends Have Flown Before from the album The Drifter's Dawn. Beautiful song. On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily. You're with me, Daniel Browning. Now to a new Australian film, well, more of an experience than a film. It's being described also as a cinematic event. It's The Turning, and it's based on novelist Tim Winton's 2004 collection of intertwined stories, set in a coastal community in Western Australia. Filmmaker Rob Connolly is behind the movie. He's invited 17 directors and actors, including Kate Blanchett, Hugo Weaving, Robin Nevin and Richard Roxburgh, to bring Tim Winton's 2004 novel The Turning to the silver screen. But as I said, this film really is more an event than a night at the movies. It's 3 hours long with an interval, and audience members also get a glossy program with their tickets. The Turning premiered at the Melbourne International Film Festival in August, and it'll soon be screened in cinemas nationally. The man who made it all happen, producer and director Rob Connolly, is with me now. Welcome to Books and Arts Daily.
Great to talk to you, Daniel. Thanks for having me on the show.
This is a huge project, a bold, audacious undertaking, bringing all these highly creative people together for one film. But before we talk about logistics, tell me about your personal relationship with that book, The Turning.
It's interesting. In our office, we, you know, when people ask why we make films, you know, there's kind of like a process of, you know, accumulating things that I like, that I read, that intrigue me, and they lie around the office. And it was literally one day, you know, I was heading to lunch with a young producer I was working with, and I picked it up, and it had been sitting. I mean, I loved it when I read it. It appealed to me. It's a cryptic puzzle of a book. You know, it's a story that unlocks itself with repeated readings. It has literal, it has abstract connections. It has this kind of collection of characters set in this town that speaks to me of a world I'm familiar with, you know. And so we went to lunch with the book and I said, I love this book. How would you make it? You know, how do you adapt this for the screen? And from there, we embarked on this kind of crazy journey.
Wow. Did you have trouble? I would imagine you probably didn't have much trouble convincing the financiers to join on to this project. But it's not an obvious book to adapt for film, is it?
Yeah, look, I think that, I mean, there's a great rule of thumb that short stories actually make for better feature films. But that idea is that one short story makes for a feature film. And for me, you know, the appeal in those stories was that they're kind of open-ended. You know, they allow the audience to kind of make up their own connections and imagination. But it was a trick because, you know, to go to investors and say, okay, we've taken this book, you know, it's Tim Winton. He's one of our greatest authors. It's a hugely popular book, but that we're going to actually have 17 creative minds interpret a chapter each was part of the challenge. But then, as you mentioned, you're having some of these people involved, like Mia Wasikowska and Kate Blanchett was acting in one, and David Wenham. It meant that there was an intrigue. It's like, oh, what would they do with it? You know, and I guess that's part of the fun that we offer the audience to come and see what some of these great creative minds did with Tim's work.
Now, there is the recurring character, the central character of Vic Lang,
yeah.
The film is staggered over various phases of his life and. But the stories aren't, in some ways, are individually contained and then aren't, because you're reminded, oh, when you hear a character say, oh, that's Vic, here he is again, here he's a different, completely different man.
Yeah.
He's a child here. How did you navigate that? How did you kind of, I guess, oversee and curate all those different visions too?
Yeah, we discussed early on, you know, how much do we connect the dots for the audience, or how much do we allow the audience to kind of investigate this work? You can watch them on their own and not even worry about the connections, or you can have fun connecting them. And I've always, you know, stayed true to a Billy Wilder quote that someone told me early in my career, which is, if you let the audience work out that 1 + 1 = 2, they'll love you forever. And I think audiences love making connections themselves. And I think a lot of modern cinema, particularly coming out of the Hollywood system, assumes that the audience would, if they're confused, there's something wrong. And so we kind of played with this idea, you know, what if each of these filmmakers was able to make their chapter in their own style with their own cast? So the pleasure of watching it is a bit like, you know, that Paul Kelly concert where a whole heap of bands got to perform a Paul Kelly song, their favourite Paul Kelly song in their own style, you know. You know, here it is, all these people doing their, Tim Winton story in their own style, and then allowing the audience to have the fun of making little connections between them if they want to.
How do you think audiences will react? Because it's not traditional filmmaking. In fact, I think Tim Winton has said he's called it an act of creative insurgency.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it's fun. It's a fun experience in the cinema. For audiences, you know, you turn up, as you mentioned, we've got this 40-page program. You know, you've got an interval in the middle. Some of the cinemas are throwing in a glass of wine. I mean, it's really making it a night out. And for me, I think that's where cinema's at. You know, I think the idea of, oh, what will I see tonight, and there's 6 or 7 sessions a day, and, you know, choosing. I think those days are kind of limited. I mean, there's so much wonderful drama on TV. You know, we live in an era of piracy where people can pirate, you know, films. So what makes the cinema experience different? I mean, we know people love going to the movies. That's not going to go away. But I think what makes it exciting for you to turn up at the cinema that night and make it a night out? And that, you know, so far I think seems to be working really well. People are kind of booking and coming along like a theatre show or like going to see a band. And I'm excited by that because as a filmmaker I love sitting with a crowd in an audience.
I'm Daniel Browning. This is Books and Arts Daily, and I'm speaking with Robert Connolly, the producer and a director, one of the directors on the film The Turning, based on Tim Winton's 2004 novel. There's some experienced filmmakers working on this project. Let's call it a project. Justin Kurzel, Warwick Thornton, a lot of people. There are also some newcomers. You've really, extended yourself. Sean Gladwell, the visual artist. Stephen Page, the choreographer. Yaron Lifshitz also does a beautiful piece in it. Why that idea of plugging the creative minds of people who work outside of film?
Yeah, initially I thought, oh, who are the filmmakers that I'd love to involve in this? And then the discussion broadened. I was like, well, why just filmmakers? You know, it's you know, Tim Winton speaks to all of us, you know, his work's so popular. And I set the bar high for myself. I said, look, I'm asking these filmmakers to have a personal connection with a story in order to make it. What's my personal connection with them? You know, so for someone like Yaron, I've been fascinated and love the work of Circa, this Brisbane-based circus company. I think they're amazing. But he's also a friend. I met him when I was 19. You know, I've always wanted to work with him on something. And it's his first screen work. You know, similarly, Stephen Page. You know, I guess it's that thing of, as a curator, you know, I've spent a decade or more seeing Stephen's work as a choreographer with Bangara. So for me, I was like, well, let's invite him to see what he does. And for me as the curator, it was so exciting. You can imagine in the office over the year, the 17 films were being made. And as they came in, it was like, what have people done with Tim Winton's work? And it was very, very exciting to hear those new voices.
One of the new voices is, of course, Mia Wasikowska. Yeah. She was one of the first people to get on board. Tell me about her story, Long Clear View, which she wrote and directed. It's a beautiful piece.
Ah, amazing, you know. And for me, here's this 23-year-old. She's our youngest filmmaker in the collection. I mean, she's an incredible actor and a visual artist and with great background and interest in photography. And she wrote this beautiful statement. So I asked each of the creative people to argue their case for the film, and she wrote this beautiful statement about how that story appealed to her because it was about a young boy who had responsibility beyond his years. And I could feel this personal connection to her as a young person who's got this incredible career that's already happening and this life unfolding in front of her. And she took her influence from the early Jane Campion short films Peel and Passionless Moments, and interestingly, of the 17 films, she was one of only two filmmakers that shot on film, not on digital cameras. I love that she's the youngest filmmaker. And she shot in this retro format. And her interest was in a portrait of a young boy and his psychology. I think her ability to look at the young Vic Lang and kind of go right to the heart of his personality type in such a visual, cinematic way is really, really quite wonderful.
It's cutely observed. Let's hear a grab now from Long Clear View, directed by the actor Mia Wasikowska. This Vic is the central character played by many different actors in The Turning. But in this story, he's a neurotic child, it's fair to say, and I reckon you might just know the voice of the narrator.
During moments of stillness, Vic often felt he could see the particles an object was made of start to move. As if he could slip his hand through anything.
Of course, the former RN presenter Julie Rigg there narrating Mia Wasikowska's episode from The Turning, a film called Long Clear View. Now, Rob Connolly, Cate Blanchett was also set to direct and then decided to take a role instead. Do you know why? What's the background there?
Yeah, she was doing the chapter with Richard Roxburgh and Robin Nevin, and I think, and her husband Andrew Upton had written this fantastic kind of script. And she decided to act in it, which was a wonderful thing for us, you know, to see her. I mean, obviously, she's one of our greatest actors. And they had been working at the Sydney Theatre Company with a young theatre director, Simon Stone, and invited him to become involved. And, you know, they actually made it in a really interesting collaborative way. They brought on board Andrew Lesney, the cinematographer who'd shot Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, and they accumulated these people and then went away for a couple of days and crafted this work that Simon directed and she starred in. And it's actually the most entertaining of the collection, I think, along with Mia's. You know, it's kind of interesting how Tim navigates his, you know, balance between, you know, humour, the darker side of human nature, you know, the more kind of spiritual side or the, you know, he investigates who we are as Australians in a multifaceted way. And I love, you know, what Cate and Richard and Robin have done on screen there in a kind of comedic piece.
And how did you decide who would work with whom? It sounds like, you know, there's a complex web of relationships there, but how did you decide as the kind of curator of the whole project?
Yeah, I took a bit of a zen-like kind of state of mind and embracing the chaos. Well, I sent the book out to people that I love the work of and invited them to read it and come back if there was a story or two that appealed to them. So we had this very organic process of people coming back and arguing their case for different films. Interestingly, there weren't any huge battles over any stories. I would have thought that there would be, but it kind of fell into a natural shape. And I'd managed to finance the film without any cast attached, which was fantastic. So it meant that I could have had all unknowns, but once the project was created, it was interesting the people that came to it. You know, we got this call from Rose Byrne, who's having this huge international career, living in New York, who loved the short story, The Turning. She'd read it when the book came out, loved it. She'd clocked that if it ever got made, she'd love to play that role. Wow. And she flew herself back from New York to come to Australia to do it at her own cost. I mean, she was so passionate about it. You know, Hugo Weaving with David Wenham because they're friends. You know, I mean, it had this natural kind of evolution as people were attracted to the project, which, you know, terrifying at times, I must say, because, you know, was this work going to come together in a whole that made sense or not? Along the journey, we weren't sure. It was a great relief when we had the premiere that it was so well received.
Let's talk about schedules and deadlines, boring stuff. But how did it all come to be? Were there multiple films being shot at once? Were there multiple casts? I'm talking about crew here. How did it unfold in that kind of logistical way? It sounds like a nightmare.
We had to kind of set it free. You know, each of the 17 chapters, we had to allow them to have their own team, their own producers, cinematographer, writers, you know, so it was literally 17 films. And then we added this animation as well, which you played a little bit from with from T.S. Eliot's Ash Wednesday poem. And we just had to see what happened. I mean, surprisingly, it was conflict free. You know, I think by setting it free, by giving people creative freedom, it kind of allowed an experimentation, which I think has led to the final work being quite an adventure for an audience.
What was Tim Winton's role? I mean, what did he say when you approached him with the idea?
I think he was a bit puzzled and bemused initially.
Well, it would be, wouldn't it?
And I know in retrospect he said, look, it was crazy enough that he thought, let's give them a go. Let's see what happens. I mean, I flew when I finished it. I guess one of the amazing things about Tim with the screen adaptations of his work is that he does set them free. He kind of allows you to take the work and go and explore it and experiment with it. And he gives you that freedom. So with that freedom comes responsibility. So when I'd finished the film, I flew over and played it in the cinema in Fremantle for him and a mate, and I was terrified of what he thought. You know, we went out for lunch afterwards and he loved it, which was a great relief because, you know, with responsibility comes, you know, that kind of anxiety. I love his work. I've read all of his books. It would have been heartbreaking if he hadn't liked it. But by the same token, we had been bold with it. You know, we had experimented and explored it in different ways. I mean, he had a few kind of little moments. I mean, his voiceover's in there too in one of the stories. In Warwick Thornton's, that's
really?
Tim's voice,
so Tim's
appearing
in the film
as the wiser voice in that story. And he took David Wenham on a road trip to a remote part of WA to pick the location that they were going to film on. So Tim had a little kind of peripheral involvement. But I've got to admire him for having the courage to let us tinker and play and interpret his wonderful book.
Now let's hear another short piece of dialogue from The Turning. This is from Bona McFarlane's Mole, directed by Justin Kurzel.
Mum and Dad told me about an oldish man called Bona. He lived by the river in a beat-up caravan, and his girlfriend had left him, and he shot himself underneath the chin, but he survived that. He had half of his face blown off, and he had a big hole in his neck around where his voice box was. So every time he spoke, he had to put his finger into his mouth, into his neck, and that just so he was able to speak. It was like something like that.
From The Turning, and that part, that's from a film called Bona McFarlane's Mole by Justin Kurzel, as I said before. Rob Connolly, was that part voiced by and played by a non-actor? He's very convincing young narrator there.
Yeah, Justin Kurzel's interest and fascination in performance is in, you know, making it as real as possible. In his amazing controversial film Snowtown, he used a lot of non-actors. And in this film, he was interested in responding to Tim's story in the idea of the mythological figure that every town has, you know, that character that's been on the peripheral of the town and everyone has a story about. And so he investigated that with non-actors. And I think that gives it a veracity, you know, it's got this something, you're watching it and you just can't quite believe these people are talking about this character in a way that I don't think performance could ever achieve. And it's a real pleasure to see something in the mix of the films that is so bold, you know, in amongst more traditional dramatic works. You know, Justin's is this kind of portrait of this man as told by these real people from this town across a kind of multi-generational interpretation of this guy. It's very personal, actually, that film, I find. I think that approach means that you don't have any of the artifice that you often get in drama. I love Justin's work. I think I'm very excited to see what he does next.
I've read that none of the other filmmakers saw each other's work before the premiere in Melbourne at the film festival. Why did you decide to do that?
Yeah, as Sean Gladwell, the visual artist, described it as like an artwork, I think, from the 16th century where they concertinaed a canvas and you'd only paint your bit and then it'd be hidden and then you'd open it up. And I wanted it to have an energy that came from them being different. I wanted the audience to watch one and then, you know, the name of the next one comes up and it's like, what will this? And then you go, you know, so you go from a traditional drama to, you know, a triptych piece from someone like Anthony Lucas, you know, who's an animator formerly, and then you go to a dance piece. So I wanted the audience to kind of feel the energy of that. And so I felt that if they saw each other's work, it could homogenize the piece. And interestingly, though, I think Tim's work permeates all of them, so that even though they are very different, there is a kind of commonality across the series, which I was very happy was there. Mm. And I think that came out of, you know, the way each of the filmmakers responded to Tim's underlying work.
Yeah, my last question, the film opens at the end of the month and it's not a normal general cinema release. It'll only show for 2 weeks. It contributes to this kind of rarefied atmosphere around this film. Why'd you decide to do that?
To make it an event, you know, that people have to, you know, kind of go out and see in the cinema. You know, it's that thing where things, you know, oh, it'll come, it'll be, you can see it some other way down the track. You know, if you want to see this, it's really, it's an event of cinema. It's a unique cinema event. I mean, I love the movies. I love that collective experience. But I also think as a filmmaker, and this is why we've done this program and we've made it a bigger event, is you have to say to an audience, thank you for coming and seeing it in the cinema. You know, I think audiences need to start being valued for making the effort to come and see it. So it's very, very exciting. The next few weeks from next Thursday are going to be fun to see how people react.
Mm. Rob Connolly, thanks for being my guest here on Books and Arts Daily.
Great to talk to you, Daniel.
Now, Rob is the producer, director and overall visionary of The Turning, which opens in limited release across the country on September the 26th.
Acoustic architecture has changed a lot since the choral works written for the basilicas of Italy. From the 20th century on, the disciplines of architecture and music began to merge and spawned brand new hybrids. Architects design music, musicians perform buildings. Acoustic Architecture, Saturday at 4 on Into the Music, part of Weekend Arts.
The Cambodian artist Amy Lee Sanford understands the horror of civil war. Her father died in Cambodia during the brutality of the Khmer Rouge regime. In the mid-1970s, Amy was lucky to escape to the US with her mother, and it's where she grew up. But she recently returned to Phnom Penh, where she's become a prominent voice in the Cambodian contemporary art scene. Her work's a kind of meditation, and it explores the lasting psychological effects of war. She's in Australia to perform her work, Break Pot Performance, and we'll find out about it shortly. Amy Lee Sanford joins me now. Welcome to Books and Arts Daily.
Thank you so much.
Now, you were born in Cambodia in 1972, good year that,
mm-hmm.
3 years before the Khmer Rouge took control of the country. But you never experienced their terror firsthand. How did you escape Cambodia?
Well, I didn't experience what people know as the killing fields, but in fact, the Khmer Rouge was bombing Phnom Penh for quite a while before they took over in 1975. So, in effect, I did experience that, but certainly not what, you know, the horrors of killing fields and stuff. And so I got to the United States by my father sent me out of the country to live with his American wife. And she came to Cambodia in July of 74, stayed for 2 weeks, and then took me away.
Mm. Now, your father, I understand, was a prominent academic. He was killed, though, at the hands of the Khmer Rouge.
Right. My father was the dean of the university, and I just learned recently that actually he was killed soon after the Khmer Rouge came in. But I think it's better that way, frankly.
Extraordinary excesses of brutality that the Khmer Rouge perpetrated on the population. You grew up in the United States, but did you grow up with a feeling of connection always to Cambodia, despite that?
I did, although for me, Cambodia was really frozen in the past. My life in the United States had nothing to do with anything Cambodian, really. And I grew up in an Irish Roman Catholic neighborhood. I was the only Asian in the town. But I still always did feel a connection, sort of an unspoken thing that bonded me much stronger than I realized.
That must have been tough.
It's something I've always lived with, so I've never known any different, you know. If I had lived as an adult without this experience and then suddenly experienced it, sure, I would notice the difference, but it's always been a part of my consciousness and part of my life.
Now, you've moved back, as I said, to Phnom Penh. I moved and live and work there as an artist. Why did you make that decision to return to Cambodia?
I first visited Cambodia. I first returned to Cambodia in 2005 when I relocated some relatives that I'd been looking for a while. And it was a good visit, but I wasn't ready to spend more time in the country. And then my life opened up in 2008, and I had the opportunity to go back. I went for an exploratory visit and then just knew right away that I wanted to spend more time there. You know, I didn't have a particular goal in mind, but more I needed to experience something that was sort of taken away from me and wanted to experience what my father's life was like, what my family, like, just sort of what would have been or what could have been, even though it's a very different place now.
The work you're bringing to Australia is called Breakpot Performance. Can you tell us a little bit about the idea behind Breakpot Performance?
Well, visually what you'll see is I sit on a cloth and I have one of these Cambodian clay pots. I let it drop and it shatters on the ground. And then I proceed to sit and glue it back together piece by piece. And so the product is usually a pot that's pretty much back together. There are holes, and it's not, you know, exactly as it was before, but it's as together as it can be. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I use the pot as an analogy for a lot of things. It can be on a personal level, it can be on a societal level, it can be on a national and international level. But the process of something suddenly breaking, suddenly changing, and then the much longer process of repairing or however, putting things back into a functioning state. Mm-hmm. And whether the pot, when I finish with it, whether it's functioning or not is another question.
So it's about that process of destruction and rehabilitation. You also just said that the Cambodia that you found when you went back there after so many years away was a different place.
Oh, it's completely a different place than when I left in 1974. I mean, it has generations of trauma. It has, you know, a government that's starting up and things are running. Not starting up, it's been going for a while. But just the whole feeling I see is to be very different. And granted, I experienced it in a different way as an infant. But there's an essence that's similar, but there's a lot that is significantly different.
Describe the pots for us. They're earthenware, and they're from, I understand, from your father's province.
Yes, they are. They're earthenware between 20 and 35 centimeters in diameter, unglazed, and they are actually pit fired. So when I first get them, there's often ashes still in them, like with straw ashes. And they're utilitarian. Mm. Everybody in Cambodia has had some contact or used them somehow. Originally, I think they were used for cooking food in. Now, I've still seen them for cooking food, but people use them for, you know, burning joss paper for the ancestors and doing all sorts of different things.
As an everyday utilitarian object, what's the significance of the pot?
Well, I chose the pot because I wanted people to recognize something and see that I was working with something that they had their own connection with, you know. So then, at least in Cambodia, people might have their own relationship to seeing someone break something that they used this morning or that they used 2 weeks ago. You know, it I think it adds another layer of meaning for the average Khmer.
There's a tension between the pot in fragments and the finished piece. What role does movement or changing states play in your work, movement?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, movement is required, is physically required in repairing the pot, but my work overall reflects change and movement. So there's, you know, there from the beginning, from the state that I use things from
before
yes, because I've also used glass and I've shattered glass and put that back together. So there's that physical process, but it's also about movement of memory, movement of stagnation, movement of things we have inside us, and bringing them to a different place.
Your story, of course, is your own, but stories of war and displacement are unfortunately pretty common. Do you find that the performance connects with people's stories of other people's stories of war and experiences that are similar to as those that might be experienced by a Khmer?
I found it connecting with other people experiencing war, but also people who haven't at all, people who have had situations in their life that change suddenly, and it takes them quite a long time to put their life back together. I've seen it's really gone across race and class, and which I find fascinating and very a rewarding part of my work.
It's incredibly personal. That's quite clear, and it's also quite intimate too. But you're doing it in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. Is that ever challenging?
When I'm actually performing, I'm very much in the moment of just putting these pieces back together. I'm not thinking about some thing in my past or something. But because it's such a private thing, or it seems like a private thing, I find it is very important to do it in public because these processes happen all the time. Mm-hmm. And usually there's not, there's no space to recognize it, or people think, oh, well, that happened 30 years ago, so people don't have a problem now. And that's not the case. But whether it's personal or on a larger scale, these things are always happening on some level.
Living in Phnom Penh, it's all right, you can cough, it's fine. Living in Phnom Penh, do you see the country, you alluded to this earlier, you see the country repairing itself and healing its wounds and owning its past. What I was struck by when I went to travel to Cambodia some years ago was I was told to prepare for a traumatised people, but I found the opposite. I found everyone was smiling. Mm-hmm. It may have been superficial, but everyone was very happy to see others.
I think there's a couple of sides of that. I mean, there's certainly a part where people are happy and very joyous and in the moment, and that's wonderful, and that might be partially because it's a Buddhist country. But also, I think there are other layers that that a lot of visitors don't have privy to see, and those other layers might be shared among family, or might be shared among other Khmer. But there's you know, the outside face, and then there's the other stuff going on inside.
Thanks for being my guest here on Books and Arts Daily, Amy Lee Sanford.
Thank you so much.
Amy Lee Sanford is a Cambodian-American visual artist. Her performance will take place next Tuesday, the 24th of September, at the Sydney Meyer Asia Centre at the University of Melbourne. That's it for Books and Arts Daily for this week. Thanks to the team, Linda Lopresti, Rhiannon Brown, Suzanne Donisthorpe, Kate Evans and Miyuki Okiranta, to John Jacobs, Tim Simons and Paul Penton. Next here on RN, it's Bush Telegraph. I'm Daniel Browning. I've had a ball. I've been filling in for Michael Cathcart. He's back with you on Monday with a host of programs from Berlin. It's been great to have your company. Stay with the network throughout your day. Bye for now and have a great weekend.
Hey, what did you think of that book? And does hearing from the writer make you like it more or less? Make you want to read more or hang out for the next story, the writer you've never heard of, a genre you've never tackled? Well, you can do all those things with me, Kate Evans, on Books Plus here on RN. It's where we select the best from a crammed bookshelf, all for you. So run your finger along those spines with me anytime at all from the RN website.